Welcome to season two of Untalented. This episode, I sit down with Laura Petricelli, co-founder and CCO of Nice & Frank. Nice & Frank's client roster is incredibly impressive. They work with iconic brands like San Francisco Giants, Amazon, and most recently, Haagen-Dazs. From launching Frank's shop to winning some huge awards, in this episode, Laura shares what it means to grow a meaningful culture. We get into the challenges of leading as a woman, the importance of forming your own point of view, and why the best creative work doesn't necessarily come from harmony, comes from people who care enough to clash, challenge, and create something better. Hope you enjoy.
We have a monthly catch-up, I call it the beach, because to me, a beach is like the perfect metaphor, I think, for a creative department. It's incredibly beautiful and inspirational. It can be dangerous and exhausting. We have a responsibility to protect the beach together, and I call creative directors lifeguards. When people get promoted, yeah. I send them lifeguard jerseys. It's really about creating an ecosystem. You know, I think leadership can become very gendered sometimes. My urge to maybe male leaders would be, you'd be fascinated to see the difference in a call, whether it's with a client or with one of your teams, or you start with a question. So I don't ask teams like, what's the best idea you've got? I say, how'd you find the brief? Asking those questions unlocks a sense of, you know, safety. What I'm proud about, and I think going back to the chapters of your career and, you know, all these different lessons that I've learned along the way, I think it's come down to me to showing up for people, showing up for my teams with a level of vulnerability and openness that inspires them to do the same thing. And it means that they can be better leaders, or we share ideas.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay. Hello.
So thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to another episode of
Untalented by Unknown. That was one of the weirdest beginnings of a podcast.
Good. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Sam.
I just want to say I'm like proud for you and what you've created in Nice & Frank. And I'm really genuinely happy to have you on this podcast.
You and my mum, Sam. I love it.
I didn't want to be like proud of you because I know we've only just met. But like, I'm proud for you and what you've created. And for those of you that don't know who you are, you have just been added onto the top 500 female leaders in the world, along with Rihanna, off the back of what is probably like a tremendous year of great Super Bowl spots and the Haagen-Dazs
Haagen-Dazs
work.
Tough. It's got a little accent, and the whole thing.
Yeah, Haagen-Dazs.
Yeah.
But also, like, I read the stat about 238% increase in revenue in 1 year, which I've never heard. That's an insane stat. So I don't even know what that means, which we're going to get into. Because this is season two, we're going to start off slightly differently. And I want to hear, what is your secret talent?
Okay. Well, you've not really heard too much of my Australian accent just yet, so you'll get to know the Laura that I am. But my hidden talent is, after spending a decade in the US, I've found that I need to create an American alter ego that sometimes pronounces things different. So this is Lauren. She's so crazy. She loves all her coworkers. She's a big fan of Coachella. And she's pretty wild. She works in PR.
How deep does Lauren go?
It depends how many drinks she's had. And the story gets deeper, as does her backstory. But yeah, Lauren pops out every now and then. And she might come again in this podcast. Who's to say? It's too early.
Let's see. Yeah. Maybe a particular type of work that we talk about. And
right. She loves that particular type of work. Yes.
Amazing. Yep. Okay. Well, I love that. Well, look, thank you for joining. And I'm keen to know about, we're going to talk a lot about Nice & Frank and about the story here, but let's go back a little bit. What got you here in the first place? Where did it all start?
Well, okay. So incredible question. Let's go back in time. You know, I think before Mad Men was a thing and like people at large understood what advertising was, lots of people didn't. Like growing up in university, I think people took the track of design or, you know, writing or journalism. And then I was one of those really lucky people that were fortunate enough to have a family member in the industry. My dad is an advertising photographer. Oh. Yeah, back in Australia. Wow. So I remember growing up and like going to the studio, like when I was like a little toddler, I have memories of like crawling around on like sets, you know, and actually one of his first projects was for an ice cream bar in Australia called Maxibon. And it was the whole set was like graves done as these big Maxibon ice cream bars. It was like a huge graveyard. And I just remember crawling around in there and like having these insane experiences as a kid. It was like a playground. And, you know, I think when you grow up with that kind of background and you get to see that you can actually make a business out of creativity, really quickly your brain goes, okay, how do I do something like that?
Yeah.
And so my mom, who's an amazing cook and a huge host, she would have the art directors and the writers back for dinner after shoots.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we would get to all have these conversations. And so as a kid, I just grow up like the language of briefs and deadlines and clients are annoying and all these phrases were things that I grew up with really early on. And clients aren't annoying. You're all wonderful. No. I love you.
Disclaimer.
But it was just like a cool way to grow up. And I think that by like 15 or 16, I was sketching like ideas for ads and things in a book. And it sort of started as early as that.
Did you lean to want like writing or art direction, do you think?
Okay, yeah. This has been the crossroads of my life really, because I think I actually have such a deep passion for both that I know usually most people, recommend that you kind of dig into one or the other. But for me, I actually got so much value caring as much about the visuals as I did the words, probably because my dad was a photographer and I was always keen on how to look at things differently and shoot things. And then writing was just something. I love storytelling and films. I was a big theater kid, which might not be surprising because you've already met Lauren. I think when you were obsessed with all those different things, like I was just a big sponge and I absorbed everything. And so I think that meant that I always had a passion to do a little bit of both, which worked really well. And then I went to an advertising school in Australia called RMIT, which is awesome. It's one of our only ones in Melbourne. Yeah. Probably anyone you've met from Melbourne went to RMIT, so shout out to RMIT.
It's usually that or like award school. That's
award
done.
School. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. And I was lucky enough to push to do an exchange program in Copenhagen. And so it was affiliated with Hyper Island. It's called DMJX. And
I know that.
Yeah, and it was great because it was just, you know, when you grow up in Australia or any country that's sometimes not America or England or some of the bigger advertising countries, you actually have to try to get experiences from other countries so that you stand out among others and that you can actually get into those other countries later on, which is ultimately for many of us the goal, you know. Yeah.
There's always a big thing with talent from Australia and New Zealand about getting a lot out of a little. Like that's why they're so successful in the UK and the US, like big time. And I mean, you've just summed it up very succinctly as well.
Yeah. But the big thing about that, mate, which I think is a superpower for, and it's funny you say New Zealand, Australia, and I'd even say Canadian advertising folks.
Yeah, big time, yeah.
Your superpower is because you didn't grow up with these giant budgets. Like we didn't work on TV briefs. Like I come to America now and my junior teams are working on like Super Bowl briefs or crazy briefs, you know. Yeah. But in Australia and New Zealand and, Canada, you have to get huge amounts of eyeballs for like 1/100th of the price, you know, 1/100th of the price. And it's like the best part about that is that you get trained early on to like, what is the PR headline this is going to earn? What is the unfair amount of attention we can grab from this idea? Yeah. And that doesn't rely on huge expense like TV. And I think that's like coming over to America. I think that's how a lot of those countries succeed so quickly, is that we have that edge to us that sometimes teams don't get trained to have from big American schools or training like that.
100%. I totally agree with you. And I see that all the time when people hire.
Totally.
All the time. Okay. Fast forward a little bit.
Yep.
What got you to Goodbye?
Oh, okay.
So we're probably skipping a lot.
And we're going to, let's just, this time machine's a little broken and that's okay. I think, Goodbye was, so I went to Grey after that, which, you know, from school. And that's just important because I had an amazing piece of learning there because, you know, Grey in a lot of countries is hundreds and hundreds of people. Grey in Melbourne had 40. Oh. And so when I was there at the time, we had a client called the Transport Accident Commission, which is all around road safety and drink driving. Mm-hmm. So my first couple of briefs in my experience were like behavioral science briefs. It was like, okay, we learned that, you know, drink driving happens the most around Christmas because people are letting go. Like, so our briefs were about how do you stop that crashes over Christmas. And so what was nice about that like upbringing creatively is that I was obsessed with strategy from the beginning because I could see that if you get handed this piece of paper, it's not just an annoying task. It's just riddled with nuggets that you can use. And I get so frustrated with creators when they're like nasty about their strategist or strategy because it's basically people dropping you off into a part of the ocean where there's a bunch of great fishes to find, you know, and like getting sort of great strategic nuggets in your briefs. Something like behavioral science does that probably the best. And that learning really helped me just in general find my passion for like things that felt like the truth, you know, and things that feel real and building ideas, not just on craft, but also on the truth. And I think that that became a huge part of my like creative upbringing, We won a huge, beautiful campaign that we did, an award that got us over to Cannes for that client. And that is where I met the wonderful Jeff Goodby, Rich Silverstein, and Margaret Johnson.
Really?
Maybe not in that order. I feel like it. I don't, who knows? The order was blurred a little bit. But it was a fantastic experience. And, like, you know, awards have a lot of downside. I think they can create a really bad narrative in the industry. But the upside is for someone in Australia working at a tiny agency to be able to go overseas with that award and get to have FaceTime with some of the big players that could become your next chapter. I think that was the huge privilege and the amazing moment for me. I did do a tequila shot with Margaret Johnson, and I think that worked at some capacity. But I had this really genuine conversation with Zach Canfield, the recruiter there, that didn't ask me one question about work. It was just really to get to know me as a person.
Oh, great. Love that.
And that to me signaled, like, that's the kind of place I want to work, yeah, that cares about me as a human first. And yes, I might have won this award, but that wasn't the premise of the entire conversation. Yeah. And that's how, I think 3 weeks later, without ever going to California ever in my life, I picked up everything and moved.
Really?
I went to Glastonbury beforehand though, which you'll appreciate.
Okay. Yeah. That is like the literally right after Cannes as well,
yeah,
isn't it?
Cannes, so, Glastonbury, moved my entire life to America, and I was 23 years old. Yeah. And it just was a bit of a, why not, you know, like, I think you got to grow up in a lucky setting to have that, yeah, attitude. And my parents are definitely like a yes and why not kind of duo that wanted me to just take every opportunity. So I just did it.
Wow. So what was that like landing there? Like,
man, it was awesome. And my first brief was for the NFL, which is hilarious.
Yes.
I couldn't tell you about the AFL, which is our Australian league in Australia. So it was cool. I mean, you just get dropped into have to absorb again and learn things differently and find a, you know, I think America has a very specific way to advertise things. And I think it, you know, coming from Australia and I'm sure like in the UK as well, like there's a little bit more subtlety sometimes to some of the humor or some of the ways that we promote products. And I think in America, I had to really quickly understand and adjust to, like, it is totally fine to hit people over the head in the first 3 seconds and do it again a couple times before the ad is finished, you know, and I had to learn that. Eric Kelman was my first ECD, who was, you know,
yep,
Captain Old Spice.
Yeah.
Is a fantastic leader, fantastic writer in terms, yeah, of like, how do you create the construct that feels memorable? And so I had to go through a huge process of unlearning going into Goodby and going into American advertising. And I actually think that most people, when you start a new job, you have to embrace a deep process of unlearning, yeah, because you have to get really good at working out the system of the new agency. You have to understand how to speak their language a little bit, which is the task of advertising in general. But it was a big process of how to let go of parts of myself, how to learn these new parts, but then how to bring in some of my individuality that would, yeah, make me stand out, which kind of goes back to that New Zealand, Australia thing. Yeah. Like, my first couple of years of success at Goodby wasn't because I was doing the big Super Bowl ads yet. It was because I was hacking PR and creating ideas, yeah, that felt shareable and had that talkability to them, that those skill sets that I learned back in Australia.
Yeah, that's so cool. And, yeah, they were open to that as well as, yes, as an agency, because some are set in their ways.
Like tunnel vision, yeah, on the pro. Yeah, I think, you know, huge respect to Goodby and the way that the agency structured. I think there was a lot of set in their ways-ness, mm, to the whole place, as most successful places are. You have to have, yeah, your ways in order to be successful. But there's a real, especially from Jeff and Rich, I got this real sense of, we understand that you know things we don't. And I think as a leader, there's something so incredibly empowering about, yeah, that. To be a younger person underneath a leader who's saying, you know what? We know that you have things to tell us that we couldn't possibly understand. So help us learn that so that you can teach our clients. I think as leaders, you know, the best thing you can do is really create space for people to be able to lean in with their superpowers.
Yeah.
I think Jeff and Rich really noticed that in me and was able to be like, don't know what she's about to say, but we're going to let her say it. God, hell, it's not, as long as it's not goddamn Lauren, we'll be okay. And, you know, they let me have the floor and I was in boardrooms and meetings. And I think in my first couple of months, I actually flew to present an idea to Taylor Swift for her 1989 world tour.
Wow.
Which is crazy because
you hate her music.
I hate her. No, and I absolutely let it be on the record. I'm a Rihanna girl and not at all. You know, it was just, I got a lot of, looking back now and I think about my young teams, I was given so much trust. And, yeah, I think there's an element of that that requires bravery from my leaders, yeah, looking, yeah, back to let me fall if, yeah, I was going to fall. I think, or let me meet Taylor Swift if I'm going to meet Taylor Swift.
That's,
yeah,
I mean, what a great story. I want to hear more about
that. That's a big one. That might be a whole other podcast,
yeah,
that day.
Okay. But, yeah. I mean, just, but leaders create, and we could talk about, yeah, leadership in a minute when we come to Nice and Frank, but,
yeah,
creating the environment to make you know, the people that you're managing feel comfortable enough to speak out and not ask, like, ask a dumb question and lean in and be curious is like so important.
Yeah.
And I can sense that that's something that Nice you do at Nice with Frank as well. But well, that's an amazing journey. So you were there for what, 7-8 years, was it?
Seven or eight years. Yep. And had lots of different chapters in that time, which is kind of, you think about staying anywhere for that long, which often in advertising people don't.
Yeah.
I think it's because it felt so different every couple of years, you know?
What changed, if you were to summarize it in a minute, like what were those two or three detrimental changes?
Yeah. I mean, I think that first bit is the unlearning, the great unlearning, figuring out what I do and don't know and finding the gaps that I fill.
Yeah.
And then once you master those gaps that you fill, you can then go, okay, so what clients here? You know, you've got to become the master of your own environment. You know, I think often teams wait for the best briefs to get handed to you. I think the strongest thing you can do, and something I tried to do as much as possible, is like identify the briefs and the creative leaders that identified with me.
Nice.
And it doesn't mean finding another woman. And it doesn't mean, you know, some of the obvious things. It means people who's, you know, when you have a coffee conversation with them, you resonate with who they are as a person, the way they're thinking about work. Because there's no way that you agree with every single creative director you have. And I think sometimes we get stuck on briefs and clients and under leadership that doesn't actually resonate with us. And so I really felt like I learned the landscape and I figured out where I could create the most value. And I started to see, we had Comcast as a client. I started to see that our activation space and our social space on Comcast was super low. I think it was one of the most hated brands maybe on social media at the time, which I was like, hell yeah, that's the brief I'm going to go after. And, you know, you can start to just play and use your own mini models of success or creativity and apply them against different clients. So I did that for Comcast. I did that on Sonic. We created the first product designed for Instagram. Sonic had really, honestly, like, it was when Instagram and food were obviously one and the same and people shooting food. And I realized that we have this food client that doesn't look good on Instagram. So we convinced them to create an Instagram friendly shake that was actually square at the time that looked perfectly shot from the square angle from top down, like latte art for shake. So I started to see how we could play with all these different notions of the way that I thought about creativity in the different clients. And that helped us escalate really quickly and you know, start to build out a philosophy at the agency. And, you know, I think that's the other thing, starting to attach language to the way that you think really early gets other teams excited to work for you. So when I got promoted to creative director, you know, instead of kind of letting that title take over me, in some ways I think we get given these titles and it bombards us. We don't know how to handle it. I tried to see how I could create language or a style on top of my leadership title. So a term that I came up with that, you know, it ended up leading to a lot of my Doritos and Frito-Lay work that then became some of my Super Bowl stuff was a term called seriously silly.
Right.
And what I mean by that, and I think it's a very Australian, you know, personality trait, is be silly, be fun and be playful. This at the end of the day is advertising. You're trying to get people to shake themselves up a bit or kind of enter a different kind of part of their brain for their day, right? So there's got to be an element of silliness to it to me, or playfulness. But the seriously is the bit where people really pay attention. When you apply craft or insight, going back to the truth, or, you know, we were talking about the beautiful Squarespace Super Bowl ad this year. That was a silly bloody idea, throwing, you know, laptops like newspaper. The craft of it was insane. I think it was Steve Rogers who directed it. I mean, it's like unbelievable craft added to the silliness. And I think that when you get that juxtaposition, it creates really beautiful work. So I would coin my third chapter at Goodby as a time where I wanted to create fun and playful ideas, whether it was social activations, but I wanted to apply a level of craft so that people really remembered it and paid attention and shared it. Because silly by itself can sometimes fade away pretty quickly. And serious by itself can do the same.
That's quite foresightful of you as well. Like, what year was that?
I think that was like 2018 or 19.
Okay.
Yep.
Because we've seen a real shift in that, haven't we?
Yes.
From brands, especially, you know, with the pandemic, taking a real interest in what they're doing across social media and activations.
Yeah, we got really serious.
And about, you know, whatever they're doing on those platforms, making sure that they are crafted to as high as possible. So I think that's really interesting. So off the back of that, you even get to ECD, don't you?
Like, yes. Geez, and there was a fun little chapter after. So 3.5 was the chapter.
3.5, because that's a whole other, like, thing,
yeah,
right?
No, jeez. It was awesome. I think I was besides Margaret Johnson, the first ECD it could be that was a woman.
Amazing.
And that was, you know, I think that statistic is changing a lot in the world, thank God. But it was at that time still super small, and I guess still today, sadly, still super small. but it was a really empowering chapter because, you know, learning how to go from being in a partnership into being a solo ECD, having a point of view that you share often just with yourself. You have to like absolutely double down on your confidence and your opinion, even when you didn't feel confident or opinionated. Yeah. You had to be like, that's right, that's wrong, this is it, this is that, and help lead with that kind of assertiveness that you don't really get taught. I think that's an experience thing. I think I was 30 when I became an ECD, so I still had a lot of life to live still, and I'd gone through all my own personal life chapters and things like that too. But during that period, I think it was when I had that moment, and I think most people that are founders will probably have this experience where I feel alone, but I feel empowered, and I feel like I can do this, and I feel like I can guide people, and I have a strong enough opinion or point of view on what creativity is that I think I could build something from, you know, the inside out. And I think when you're inside an agency as an ECD, you're still, you know, you're still taking the model around you and making it adapt. But I was able to start to formulate some ideas in my head that would, you know, eventually become the premise of Nice and Frank. And it was during that time, and I guess honestly, on the outskirts of those entire 3.5 chapters, my co-founder Graham North and I, who's our chief creative, chief strategy officer, he and I would do this thing called Brand Camp, which is essentially, you know, a two-day workshop where we'd get C-suite and founders in the room, and we would build a proposition or a organizing idea or a landing point for them in just 2 days.
Really?
We started doing it with startups in the Silicon Valley, and we were doing it again on the weekends. At times, we were doing it at Goodby. And it was such a cool training ground because in contrast to like the hierarchy of some of the big brands I was working as an ECD, you know, managing and having like 100 creatives, I started to do this process that felt incredibly raw and vulnerable. Yeah. And like we say camp because it felt like that, you know. And I think, you know, having those experiences juxtaposed, I was like, there is validity in this industry to do the big process driven brand work. And that's always going to be important. But there's also validity in like working a little differently to get to the answers from a slightly different angle, more honest place.
Yeah.
And it was those experiences together that was like the big unlock for me, where I then moved to New York. I was going to, you know, help us kind of continue setting up the New York agency for Goodby here. And I remember just as soon as I landed, I was like, I've got the experience, I've got the confidence, and now I just have to make the jump. I think I can do it. And I had just this like crazy feeling in my stomach that the time is now.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It was weird. It was like, I literally touched down. Had my two cats underneath my arm, say you're a lesbian without saying you're a lesbian, and then off I went. And it was just like a feeling that I had, and this amazing experience that I had at Goodby combined with some of these incredible experiences I had with Graham that just felt like the unlock.
That's awesome. So I'm so curious about hearing more about this process, Brand Camp, and I'm sure is what you've done or what you do at Nice and Frank kind of that but times two, like how let's talk to me about the Nice and Frank story now.
Yeah,
like, and kind of
it's a great question because I think like going back to the unlearning thing, even the processes that I was proud of at Goodby or during that chapter between, you know, the way I worked on Doritos and building out a mini agency in the agency, or, you know, the experiences we had at Brand Camp, there's flavors of everything that we needed to take, you know, for Nice and Frank. And I sometimes say this to clients about taglines, and now I'm about to say it about myself. When we came up with our name, which is kind of a whole story in of itself, which I'll tell you about, but Nice and Frank, you know, names are truly, and taglines and words are truly just like tofu. They don't have any fucking flavor at the start, you know. They have to absorb the personality and the flavors of the things that you create. And so an agency was kind of like that for us. We had to bring together, I think, all these different flavors of experiences that we had to build what became the name Nice and Frank. And really the heart of it is, it was originally called Frank. And the heart of it is just how much I think that truth and honesty, going back to the behavioral science stuff, going back to just, I think how I like to show up in rooms with clients. Like the way I'm speaking to you right now is how I speak to my friends and my mom and my clients. It's all the same, you know, except when Lauren's involved. And I think the important part about that is like when you show up honestly in business, shock horror, clients love it. Yeah. You know, they don't want to be talked to like they're your client, that there's this like black and white decision to be made and this big, long, scary boardroom. They want to feel like you're on the same team.
Your peer.
You know, they're your peer. Yeah.
Like a partner,
I'm going to say something to you because it's not because I want to get more money out of you. I'm going to say it because it's the truth.
Yeah.
And that has, and then by the way, that gets more money out of them. Yeah. You know what I mean? So frankness is like a DNA part of, I think, how we are. And Graham is exactly the same. And he's Canadian, so I think we've got this, you know, Commonwealth honesty to us that we can't avoid. And I think that's really palpable in the room and in spaces. And I think what I love about frankness and the way that it shows up in business is that, you know, unfortunately, it's very rare. Mm. And I think when you lead with honesty, it changes not just the dynamics of how people work, but the work shows up a little bit more brutally honest too, you know. And so Frank was the premise of our name at the beginning. Yeah. When we started the company, we went out with like a LinkedIn post and all of a sudden we got attacked by all these other Franks in the world. There was a Frank Design thing, a Frank Collective and our lawyers had said, don't worry about it. There's so many Franks, they won't come after you. But we got bullied by the Franks.
The bloody Franks.
You'd never think it. And so we just went out with a social post and we're like, you know what? This has actually taught us something, that you can be frank and frankness is important, but without the kindness, without being nice, you can actually kind of just be an asshole. Yeah. And so we posted something on social media that was like, there's plenty Franks in the ocean, including Frank Ocean. And so while the other Franks got naughty, we decided to get nice. And honestly, it's become like this incredible grounding point for us, because now when we give feedback to our teams, when we get feedback from clients, we have a nice column and a frank column. So tell us the truth. Tell us what you really think. But do it kindly, do it gently, or tell us what else was nice, what was great about it. And it creates this really equal kind of workplace from a cultural standpoint, and it gives our clients kind of something to grab onto to help give better feedback too, which I think is a really big thing that we lack in the industry in general.
100%, I'm fully with you there. And I love that story about the Franks and becoming nice and frank. It sounds better than kind and frank, I guess. But
yes, there you go.
But Frank Shop, that's a thing, isn't it?
Yes.
So how does that work within a brand, and when does that come into play?
Yeah,
I'm kind of curious about that.
No, it's great. And honestly, I think starting out, it's so important to have a point of difference.
Yeah.
You know, and that millions of indies out there, and I bet there's people watching or listening right now that maybe want to start their own agency. And I think the biggest accent you can make is become the spin-off agency of your big mothership, you know? And for us, Frank Shop was an accumulation of the way that we worked, the honesty and collaboration, met with some of the principles we've been experimenting with at Brand Camp. And Frank Shop became this process where it was like an honesty, vulnerability driven kind of creative workshop, creative and strategic workshop, where our promise is that in 4 to 6 weeks, we will land an organizing idea or a new North Star for your brand in the room with your highest decision makers. So we have C-suite in the room. We also encourage them to bring their like head of social, like the person who's going to have to activate this on Monday. You know what I mean? And so we create a really small collaborative room. It's driven by insight and cultural deep dives and nuggets. And Graham, he's got a background in, you know, his dad was an amazing moderator. And so he's got this like infused ability to, you know, hold space for really complicated conversations, which I think great strategists can do. And we use that in that room. That first day, it's divided into 2 days. That first day, we sometimes call it the therapy session. You know, it's where tears are sometimes honestly shed, where C-suite and like their new CMO or whatever comes in and they're able to like have these really important debates that maybe they don't have the space to have in other rooms or other places. And so Graham, you know, with our amazing strategy team, helps craft these conversations. We have a section called Frank Takes, where it's like, here are some honest things we're hearing. A lot of stuff is anonymized.
Yeah.
We do one-on-one interviews with the whole company. And then, of course, sometimes we conduct our own research. Wow. And the whole point of it is like, let's unearth some truths. Let's dig for truth and unearth some truths that they haven't heard yet, they haven't seen yet, or haven't reflected on, or they haven't had the bravery yet to do it.
What was the most surprising piece of kind of feedback that you've ever had for a brand? Like, has anything really stood out? You'd be like, wow.
Oh, man, there's so many dynamics that come into play, which is so interesting. Like, we definitely had one time where a brand leader said, I completely hate the way that we're approaching social media, and we're going to start from scratch. And the agreement was made in that room that day, and they wiped their socials and started again. Cool. And it, you know, it led to like, I think, you know, the next chapter, it led to like one of the most liked Instagram posts of all time. So a decision in the room like that in a really vulnerable space can have a huge impact afterwards, but you need to create the impetus for that ripple effect, which I think Frank Shop becomes kind of the moment of change for a lot of brands, which was really special. I think on other times we've had, we've had like family dynamics, even like some of the businesses we work with, the family run businesses, which is really interesting, because all of a sudden these family therapy moments start to come out. Like, if anyone's done family therapy, we all know some things get said. So, you know, there's some real big truths that get unearthed. And I think that it can become, I think in other environments, the truth can really be scary. And I think in this environment it becomes, you know, an act of change or bravery, which is really cool.
Wow. I love that. And that is severely distinctive.
Yes.
Compared to what else is out there.
Yep. Yep.
Do you think that could work in a big network? That Ooh. Kind of approach, or does it work because you're independent and you're nimble? Like,
I think people are more willing to be vulnerable in smaller spaces. Yeah. I think if you're coming to a giant agency with a big reputation, I think sometimes you're not able to show up as intimately. Like, if you and I were talking right now with 15 people, I'm probably not saying the same things to you, right? And I think there is a little bit of that comes into play. And I think it is, you know, such a human process. And I think so much about, you know, as a founder, you're constantly wondering, you said it before, like you're always looking around the corner. What could be the thing that defeats us? What could be the thing that stops our, you know, 238%, you know, revenue success? And I think it's, you know, to me, it's like holding on to the human vulnerability and honesty that makes us a distinct offering when AI cannot do that. And I don't think it will ever be able to do that, to read the nuances in the room, to feel the unsaid things. You know, we, one of our biggest phrases at the company that Graham coined is what's the quiet part loud here? In a brief, there are quiet parts loud. In a conversation, there are. In meetings, intentions, there are. And I think that is a huge inspiration, I think, for us just in general and how we show up. And I think, you know, big agencies are very bad at saying the quiet part loud, and even when it really needs to be said loudly. And I think that you get the privilege of doing that in smaller spaces as an indie shop, you know. And then, of course, that first day then leads to the second day, which is a creative unpacking of those truths now reflected as, you know, different ways in, as honest ways in. And, you know, sometimes they take the form of manifestos and ideas. Other times they're just like a general area that we could go down. It's not the promise that we crack the campaign in the room.
Yeah.
But we will crack a way forward. Then we go on to do creative development after that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can imagine 3 months after this process, when I'm in a room now presenting Super Bowl scripts or activation ideas, that trust that you build in the Frank Shop room, it stays with you, you know. It's like the greatest way to kind of get to know a client and them to get to know you. And that, I think, the biggest unlock to the best creative work is trust.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're building an enormous and unfair amount of trust in that space, which helps us get lots and lots of work for months to come, which I think is the reason for the success.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That really does. I completely understand how that makes you distinctive. It's like the most thorough onboarding of a client.
Big time.
Totally different to what I've heard before as
And I think the challenge for that for us sometimes, mate, is when we get traditional pitches that come to us.
We actually didn't
pitch for the first year because we had Frank Shop and we built another process called Frank Storm, which is a creative version of that. So if you've got your North Star, Frank Storm is for the brands that have that, but they still need to, you know, build on creative relevance or cultural relevance. And so we'll design, you know, again, it's more like a creative development process, but it's still infused with different moments or things that create a need for truth. Yeah. So, for example, we start off every single Frank Storm with a thing called the Tastemaker, which is a trade-off. It's like it's kind of like a board game. It's like I become a, you know, TV show game host, which is my other calling potentially.
I'm just imagining you as the Monopoly guy. Yeah, right now.
And I am in many ways. Do not pass go, Sam.
Go to jail.
Yeah, go to jail or right now. But we, you know, we did the Tastemaker thing. It's basically like I show them two ads that are distinctively different for certain reasons, and I get the clients to debate live in front of each other what they do or don't like about other ads in different categories. Yeah. And the idea is that, like, we as a creative team then finally understand this big void that we have sometimes in creative client relationships, which is like, what do you actually like?
Yeah.
We know the brief, but that doesn't tell me about taste. Mm. And taste is, I think, another huge unlock to Braver Idea, really understanding and aligning on it. So we infuse some of these processes from Frank Shop into Frank Storm, and that really helped us kind of build out a new way forward that really stands out against the rest, against other offerings and things like that, which I think is really important.
The power of collaboration is real.
Yes.
And that's what you mean by creativity is collaboration. If you get brands working with us closer and we really understand every nook and cranny of how they work, who the decision maker is, how they interact with each other, if you've got to get sign off from one person or another person, that makes a hell of a lot of sense.
Yes. Yes, big time.
Wow.
It's kind of crucial, and I think the word collaboration has been abused in some ways. Like, and I think what I mean by that is it sounds really good in theory, and I think so many people in practice don't really know how to approach collaboration with the right way. And I actually think the biggest enemy of collaboration is ego. I think it's that creatives, I always say that the sentence that kills the best work is, I had this idea. And the reason what I mean by that is, like, so many of us as creatives, we want to carry this badge, this ego of, I came up with it. And I think that's a really, triggering thing for people when they feel like that credit gets taken away, or my boss didn't know that I said the line first and therefore I'm not going to get the this. And I think the truth is, collaboration is really like, we had the best idea. And that doesn't actually mean that you didn't have it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it actually says that, you know, you actually multiply the chance of an idea having a breakthrough ability or a bigness to it, or, a culture breaking ability to it when more people are involved. Because, some of these processes we talked about, you can kind of feel that I'm bringing the client along the ride.
Yeah.
I'm not waiting for the aha moment at the end of the presentation. I'm wanting them to feel it. I want them to feel it throughout. I want them to even say something, often in the first day of Frank Shop or some sessions in Frank Storm, clients say something and I tell teams, use that. That is a great line, or that is a great sentence. Put that in the presentation next week and watch how much credibility we earn by saying, we came up with this. And so all of a sudden in the situation of selling in a big idea, maybe to the head honcho that's not even in the room, all of a sudden you've got activists inside the building versus just the agency fighting for an idea. I've got clients fighting for their idea as well to their bosses because they believe in it, because they feel like they were part of building it. And I think this is crucial in this next chapter of the industry, because you've got so many brands now building incredible internal chops. Like some of my favorite clients right now, some accounts I can't talk about, but I wish I could, are from people that went from agency side into brands. And so all of a sudden we've got taste inside brands like we've never had before. People who've come from agency life, and they're able to kind of help us shepherd great ideas through the building.
Yeah.
I think it's on all of us. I think back in the day, that ego of, I came up with it, or our agency thought of it, the client didn't, was like that tension stopped us from maybe opening ourselves up to some of the best ideas we could have.
Yeah.
Now I think we have to find better ways to work with the internal teams, or we're literally just shooting ourselves in the foot. We're going to turn around in 5 years and agencies might be gone because we never found a way to collaborate together.
Well, it's no secret that more internal talents and more internal creative teams are popping up, and some of them are incredible.
They're great.
As well. Like, some of the best creatives in the industry have exited to work at some of the biggest and best brands in the world.
Yep.
So how does that differ then to, let's say, a marketing team working with an internal creative team that has come from an ad agency, for example? Like,
I mean,
how does that differ in a process like Frank Shop?
Oh, it's a great question. I think, like, to me, going back to the one-on-one anonymous interviews that we sometimes do at Frank Shop or in Frank Storm, we do the tastemaker. It's really important. Well, it's a really valuable thing, because having an agency person inside the building, inside the brand, they get to hold two things at once. They know what good taste is. They know what a good ad looks like. They know what's going to move culture. And they're learning to know more and more about their brand.
Mm.
And what we sometimes don't know as creatives or as an agency, we don't know all the secret nuggets of the brand.
Yeah.
And brand people don't know all the ways that culture can be broken with great creative. And so we have this superpower now. We have these people internally that can actually do both. So in those one-on-one interviews or in a Frank Storm, I try and give the microphone over as much as possible to that creative or the agency person inside the brand, because they can actually kind of speak both languages, and they can tell us things we need to know that we don't, and they can tell their brand stuff that they need to know that they don't. And so I think, like, really for me, my human strategy towards it is just, I should be treating that person as a co-creative director or co-creative CCO, because we are going to collectively build this next chapter together. I'm not going to push it on them and they're not going to push it on me, and I think that's where our process really leans into people like that, gives them the voice and allows us to kind of use that in the work so that it becomes this, like, this front together instead of just one side or two sides.
Okay. I really feel that when you would be in that room, just how open and curious, and the environment that you would create for everybody to feel comfortable would be one of the best, in my opinion, for anybody to succeed. I'd love to know more about your particular leadership style,
yep.
about how you run a team, how you kind of get the best out of them as well, and how do you do create those environments as well. Like, what would you say, like, your leadership style is?
Oh, okay.
Being one of the, number one, or like, whatever, top 500 female leaders in the world, which is unbelievable. It's so cool.
It's so silly little number.
Are you proud of that?
I am very proud of it.
You should be. It's an amazing feat. Like,
I am, and it's, you know, it was a really amazing thing. I'll quickly just, the day that I found out about that award, this is a credit to my incredible agency and the way they show up for me as well, which was, I had no idea we entered it. And
Who did it?
I think Graham led it with, you know, a couple of our other team members, a girl called Goose, Maria Ragusa, who's one of our strategy directors, and Drew Forrest, our, you know, connection strategist. Like, all these people came together and we just filled out this thing, made me sound awesome. And, you know, I had no idea about it. So we were actually giving a cake to our youngest employee who won a Gen Z of the Year award for AdAge. Her name's Drew, who's an incredible force of nature already. And we got a cake for her, and it was getting delivered. And we surprised her, and we had the whole agency on, and then we're all celebrating, and then this other cake rocks up. And I was like, what the hell is this? And I read it, and the cake said, what does Laura and Rihanna have in common? And I was like, well, besides lots of things that we don't have in common, I was trying to rack my brain. And, you know, and then they all came out and said, well, you've won this Inc. Fortune 500 thing. And I was like, this is wild. So,
so cool.
It was a really amazing experience. And I think, you know, what I'm proud about, and I think going back to the chapters of your career and, you know, all these different lessons that I've learned along the way, I think it's come down to me to, you know, showing up for people, showing up for my teams with a level of vulnerability and openness that inspires them to do the same thing. And it means that they can be better leaders, or that we share ideas, if that makes sense. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of creative leaders in my time that needed to be the one to say the line. Like I said before, it was my idea. I think my spirit, I love the idea of, you know, our role should be plant the damn seeds of the best idea possible. I my job isn't to see the whole tree grow. At this point, it's like, I want to sprinkle ideas in. Like, sometimes I'll just, I don't always love to just wait for my creative teams to come up with absolutely everything and see it at the very end. I love to kind of touch base with them in these like mini moments of sporadic kind of conversations. I think many of my teams will probably say that I give them a call out of nowhere and just like, okay, what are you liking about the brief? What's challenging about it? Like, I try and get them to like bring me into a little bit of the process, not because I want to micromanage or challenge them, just because I think the best thing a leader can do is continue to sprinkle inspiration and energy along the process, because burnout is when you feel alone, and burnout is when you feel like like there's nothing to draw from, you know? And so if my biggest role could be to constantly show up with an openness, a collaborative spirit that says like, I'm in it with you, and I can sprinkle some ideas in too, without being controlling, I think that's one of the best things you can do, because it inspires like that ripple effect of collaboration through the whole teams. And sometimes I also like to put teams together that don't usually exist together, you know? And I think, you know, I'm sure that you find this in your job too, is like finding unexpected combinations leads to unexpected combinations in the work, right? Yeah. It's challenging at first, and you've got to get people to do that process of unlearning.
Yeah.
Wait, usually I work with this person or this guy, or I'm a writer and they're an art director. This person's not one of those things. But if you can open up a little bit more of a dialogue between like, okay, I've got these superpowers. This isn't my role. These are just my superpowers. How can we combine these things in an unexpected way to make work that doesn't feel expected? You know, and I think that first year of our agency, I'm proud because we made a true crime podcast in our first year. We made a Stanford curriculum in our first year, and we branded it a new health AI course for Stanford.
Yeah. I read about that.
We did through a Frank shop. We did a Haagen-Dazs Super Bowl commercial. Like, these outputs are so different. Yeah. And what I'm proud about is, like, I think it's really because what I try to get the teams to do is work through this kind of amalgamation of skill sets so that the work shows up different too. And I think that is something I always want to try to push for. And, you know, you've got to create a safe space for that. We have a monthly catch up. I call it the beach.
Yeah.
Not just because I'm Australian, but because to me, a beach is like the perfect metaphor, I think, for a creative department. It's incredibly beautiful and inspirational. It can be dangerous and exhausting.
Yeah.
And I think like we have a responsibility to protect the beach together. And I call creative directors lifeguards. When people get promoted, I send them lifeguard jerseys, you know, and I again, because I am Australian, I'm scared of sharks, but as everyone should be, but it's really about creating an ecosystem together, you know? And I think if you can feed that collectively, that the work just feels, it feels bigger, you know, it feels like you're making braver decisions.
That's inspiring. I think I really hope there's somebody out there that listens to that and understands the power of how being a vulnerable leader and also leaning into that can lead to far greater work and a happier environment. It does make me wonder about, you know, female leadership as well, and whether, you know, the female leaders that you've worked with in the past or know run their teams in a similar in a similar way, because this might be a massive stereotype. I hear stories about that all the time, about big egos in leadership who are male.
Yep.
So I'm just interested in
men egos. What are you talking about?
No, you know what I mean. Though. On a serious note, I'm just really curious to hear your opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean,
as a bloke myself, I want to make sure I'm asking the right
questions. No, it's a great question, and you know, I think leadership can become very gendered sometimes, you know, in conversations. And I think my urge to maybe male leaders would be, you know, I've had some incredible male counterparts, like Graham is a great example of it. People who lead regardless of gender, just with this huge sense of empathy and curiosity. You'll be shocked how many times, you know, we talked about this earlier, how many times I was in meetings where people would just start the call with a opinion or an answer. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes could be a very masculine way to do it. I think everyone can do it sometimes, but you'd be fascinated to see the difference in a call, whether it's with a client or with one of your teams, where you start with a question. So I don't ask teams like, what's the best idea you've got? I say, how'd you find the brief? What was the most challenging? Asking those questions unlocks a sense of, you know, safety. And you straight away get that safety from someone. And then the work all of a sudden becomes this natural conversation that you get to. And I think that women just in general have an ability to read the room and to feel empathetic and maybe to lean into those traits of empathy and curiosity more often. Sometimes they don't, you know, and I think that I think the challenge with a lot of women growing up in an industry, like let's even look at it 5 to 10 years ago, there was still such a lack of female leadership that I actually do think a lot of females have, you know, come into the industry with a lot of, you know, the need to feel defensive because they've had to fight their way up. And so what I'm really excited about this next chapter of the industry is women who haven't felt like they've needed to fight their way, men who feel like they can let down their guard a little bit and let their ego settle just to create an equal playing field, you know. And I think when those two things happen, we'll be able to start to see it happening. But it's going to take still a lot of time and effort. And I think on the other side, you know, the increase in female leadership I'm seeing from a brand side has exponentially grown, which is so cool to see. Awesome. I've told this story a couple of times, but when I was at the Adweek panel for Super Bowl in New Orleans this year, I was with our client from Haagen-Dazs, Elizabeth Marquez, and she's just a very open, vulnerable, honest leader. And I see the way it affects her team. And so her and I together with the same sort of principles as leadership, I think it led to some huge, brave decisions that I don't think you'd otherwise get to. And I'll also say she was the only CMO on the panel to even cite the name of their agency.
Really?
Which, and I think that, I don't know, I really have, I don't think I'll ever forget that because, you know, I think that's another sign of female leadership. I don't think that we're afraid to celebrate other people sometimes as much. And I would just really hope and urge everybody to kind of take the back seat as much as possible as a leader. You know, going back to your question around Goodby kind of giving me the stage at times, like that helped me succeed. And the enormous power we would get as leaders by taking the back seat and letting people step up, whether you're a male leader or a female leader, I think that's going to be, you know, the real key to unlocking the next chapter of the industry, you know, because that's what I want to be looking out for. Like, who are the next leaders behind us, you know, 100%. And we need to start setting up the groundwork to make that easier for them.
100%. Oh, that's amazing. Have we got time for one more question? Okay, cool. Thank you for that. That makes so much sense. And it's exactly what I wanted and needed to hear, I think. But I'm before we end.
Yep.
Do you have like a funny little disaster story about a pitch or about somewhere where and you kind of look back and you kind of go, oh, I learned a lot from that, but it was also quite embarrassing and hard to take at the time.
Wow. I have so many of those. I think it's the best thing about being successful is that you've actually have that many failure stories to get there.
Are there any that have stood out to you, which have been like, or just like a piece of work that you like, it flopped and you're like,
oh
God, I like.
Okay, I've got one.
Go on it.
I'm very lucky in my life that I've got to work with a lot of celebrities. And also it is terrifying to work with celebrities, you know, because they come with their own set of experiences and expectations. They are like four brands in one. You're pleasing your brand that is the product, then you're pleasing them as the person they are. And I got this amazing piece of advice from an amazing director who said to me, Laura, the celebrity you're working with is going to stay the age. They're going to be the age they were when they became famous. So if you're working with a child star, celebrity. Get ready. And I worked with a celebrity. I probably can't say her name, but maybe you'll be able to guess, and that's totally fine. But, you know, she runs a huge empire, you know, and you know, we had, at first I was in the pitch meeting, I was wearing the same leather jacket she was wearing. So instantly earned her credibility. You know, I was like, okay, this is how to win this game. Yeah, we're going to do it. But months later throughout the process, I think she started to see me as competition, which is hilarious because I'm not at all at anywhere near her level. It was like kind of one of the tougher experiences of my career where I felt like I was kind of getting bullied by this celebrity on set and otherwise. So one time I was presenting a script to her and I was reading it out and it was back in the day where we're on like the telecom crazy thing where you're always scared you're not on mute, one of those ones. Yeah. And so I was in our office and she was in LA and I was presenting a script and then I went on Instagram. And she was swirling around on a swivel chair. You can hear me presenting the script in the background, going bored as she's swinging around. So I got cyberbullied. Yeah.
No.
Yep. So I think
really, that's actually what.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing achievement, really, when I look at it. But like, you are going to deal with difficult characters, especially when you're on those front lines of big projects like that, and you might have to face some difficult characters. And honestly, the work wasn't great, you know, and I'm not surprised. It goes back to the opposite of what we just talked about. Yeah. Like people who don't want to lean in, don't want to accept their role in a problem or, the curiosity to accept the problem. And you can end up with really bad work when everybody's trying to please one person is just not it for great work.
It sounds like brands have come so far, though, since that point 100%. As well.
100%. Yeah, it's a good point. That was a good 5 years ago. So, you know, and even now, like my experience with like the Fast and the Furious team this year, like I was on the phone with Michelle Rodriguez wanting to brainstorm like lines differently. Wow. And with our amazing team, Erica and Nicole, like they were workshopping things together, which is nuts. You know, I think they've also flipped a switch where they can see the validity in working more collaboratively too. Yeah. So it's good to see that switch flip, but it was a bit dark there for a second.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything that you would like to say to the listener before we end?
You know, one thing I was thinking, Sam, is like the importance of young teams, and doesn't just have to be in the creative department, but starting to form your point of view as early as possible. Okay. I think sometimes people wait till they become the title or they become a founder to create a point of view. But you should really, every single project you're working on, start to sharpen your little turns of phrase. Or like, I think a big part of Graham and I's success is that we've coined things different names and we've built new meaning into words and systems. Like, I think if everybody who would want to lead a department or create their own agency, if you start to coin your own terms or come up with your own phrases, like Seriously Silly back when I was working on Doritos, you can start to really become a stronger voice and have a sharper opinion that will just do well for you in your career, whether it's in a meeting, you have a better opinion, or when you're leading a team or building your agency. I think you'll just always be a little bit of a clearer leader. And I think that's what people need. Clarity is I think the big success here, and that requires you being able to speak about your vision, and you can practice it as early as your first brief you ever get.
I love that. Oh, a lovely way to end. Thank you so much.